Hello, everybody. Welcome to Mindful Metal Jacket. I am Joe List, and we are back with fresh, full, new interview episodes. I'm so excited. Thank you for your patience. I took a little bit of a hiatus, and I want to thank again the producers of this show who kindly put together some compilations of past episodes, which people seem to really enjoy. I appreciate you sticking around for it, and I hope welcome to any new folks that may be coming in. Please subscribe, go back and listen to old episodes. There are hours and hours and hours of interviews with comedians and Buddhists, meditation teachers, authors, doctors, scientists, all kinds of stuff, talking about anxiety, stress, therapy, all kinds of mental health. And I think there's a lot of laughs in there and certainly a lot of wisdom. So go check it out. You can watch it on YouTube, my YouTube. Make sure to subscribe to that or Laugh Buttons YouTube. And you can go and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave a nice review, leave a nice comment, share, like, all the things that all us podcasts would like you to do. You know how it goes. Took a little bit of a hiatus, been a little overwhelmed with stuff as we got back into real life. I hope everybody's healthy and transitioning back into real life. Again, it's very exciting. I don't think I've ever been more grateful for anything in my life to be at the Comedy Cellar, packed, sold out, no masks, no plastic, no nothing. Well, not no nothing, something. Love, an exchange of ideas, laughs. You get it. Anyways, I'm glad you're here today. Very special episode back. I am chatting with one of my best friends in the whole wide world of all time. Not only that, but in my opinion, the best comedian to come out in the last, I don't know, when he started, 15 years. I just think he's the best. It's Sam Morril. You already knew that, I assume. It's written in the episode thing below me, if you're watching. It sounded like I just said below me, which is a joke from my previous special. Anyways, Sam Morril is one of my best friends. I've known him a long time. We had a great conversation. I was in Austin at the time. We talked over Zoom. And like I said, Sam is one of my favorite comedians. I think we might talk about it. When I first met Sam, I actually wasn't a huge fan of him personally. I was blown away by his comedy. Not that I wasn't a huge fan, I liked him, but we had a contentious first trip. We flew to the wrong airport. I think we discussed all this. We went on the wrong day to the wrong airport. Sam couldn't drive well, and I was also in the throes of alcoholism, anxiety, and my life was sort of coming apart at the seams. So in my mind, I was blaming him, and as you do when you're a drunk, anxious, depressed person. But anyways, now we're great friends and have been for many years, and he's one of my most supportive friends, and I feel grateful that I know him, and I feel grateful that I get to watch his comedy, as should you. I'm sure you've seen his special, and if you haven't, make sure to watch it. It's on YouTube. It's got millions of views, and then he put out another special during pandemic. And he's one of the most prolific writers, and he makes me want to be a better comic. And we had a great conversation. We talked about his upbringing and his parents' divorce, his stepfather, his bad back, anxiety, therapy, Alan, and comedy, a lot of comedy talk, and his approach to writing. And it was just a great conversation. I enjoyed the hell out of it, and I can't think of a better way to get us back into the swing of things with Mindful Metal Jacket. So I'm glad you're here, and I'll shut up, and you guys can enjoy the conversation. But first, a little wisdom from the great T.S. Eliot, who is a wonderful writer who I've read none of his stuff. And it's pretty simple. He said, every moment is a fresh beginning. Right, folks? This moment right here, you could begin again. Let go of everything you were worried about and enjoy this conversation with the great Sam Morril. Thank you. I love you.
Hey,
All right, I'm here. We're back. This is like the first episode back after hiatus, and I had to go one of my best buds in the world, Sam Morrell.
I'm honored to be asked to do it, man.
Yeah, man. I'm excited to have you. Well, first of all, I never get to see you. I think we've probably talked about this before, but which is my number one line on every podcast, but I'm just so self-conscious. As a comic, I'm so self-conscious about people hearing me say stuff I've said before. Do you have that at all? Or you don't give a shit?
Of course. Yeah. Okay. No, I drink. So I repeat myself. It's embarrassing. It's like, it's terrible.
Yeah. Because all the fans of Tuesdays with Stories, I just say that before everything. Because I'm like, I think we talked about this because we've done 700 hours. And everyone gives me shit. And Mark gives me shit. But I'm like, well, I feel like a dick telling a story. Because I hate when people tell me a story. And I'm like, yeah, you told me this already, you dickhead.
Yeah, and then when it's on a show that's for entertainment, you know, the people are like, oh, all right, grandpa, you know, it's brutal.
And then you got to be careful, too, because we end up going in the same lines, like, you know, because you have your style. So I start telling a story and then like Mark's like says the same thing he said 3 years ago. And then I respond with the same thing. And I'm like, we're in full repeat here.
3 years is fine, though. That's like 3 years. And also, I always say this, if it's a good story, then who gives a shit? And it's been 3 years.
That's what people have said. They're like, we're happy to hear it over again, whatever. So, but anyways, now I forget my original point that I started to say. But oh, this is what I was going to say is I have this old DVD called Comedy All-Stars. And it's like all those 80s got Larry Miller and Bill Maher and Paul Reiser. It's great. And they're all talking comedy. But Bill Maher has this really like touching moment where he's like, the hard thing is none of us get to see each other anymore. And he's like, that's what I miss. And that's the thing with the more success you get, the less you see each other.
It's because Bill Maher won't have any of them on his show. That's why he doesn't get to see them. No, I feel the same way. It's crazy. It's like we used to hang out all the time. And it's just not, I mean, it's just not a thing anymore because we're all doing our own thing. We're on the road. It's tough.
Yeah, there was moments at the Cellar. I guess we were working the road then, but maybe not as much. But there was a bunch of time, I guess the Cellar bookings changed a bit, where the show would be like you, me, Mark, Phil, Hanley. Yeah. And like in a row. There was a couple of those shows.
Yeah, and then Guy Branum wrote an article about diversity at the Cellar, and it all came crashing down.
God damn it, Guy. By the way, the way your chair is, it looks a little bit like you have a long mullet.
I need that support. I look like Stephen Hawking, I know, but I need this support for my back. So
yeah, that's a topic to get into because back problems is like my biggest fear. I know you continuously have back problems, right?
Mm-hmm. It's gotten a lot better. I do crazy shit to work on it. I put work into my back now. I used to just be like, oh, it's out. This is gonna be 2 weeks, you know?
Right. So what is like the original injury? Because like, you know me, if I burned my thumb earlier on tea and that's going to be my next few days. Like, I'm like, I canceled appointments and shit. I'm like, I can't do it. I'm fucked. That's all I can think about. So a back being out, like how much mental capacity does this take up in your life?
I think I just accepted that it would suck. Like I remember I was in Springfield, Missouri, like 2 years ago at that room, Blue Room. And my back was completely out. And then I had some sort of like 24-hour bug where I just couldn't keep food down. So I was vomiting and I would have water and I would immediately have to run to the toilet and have diarrhea. Like, so I couldn't keep anything down. I was so ill. And I'm like, I go to the ER and they're like, yeah, you can't eat food for like 24 hours. And I was like curled up in a ball. And I was like, this is, and then I went on, did shows. I was like hunched over a stool telling jokes. And I was like, I can't live like this. This is embarrassing. And then I waited like another year and a half to do anything about it. So that's how on it I am, you know?
Wait, so was the back injury causing you to throw up?
No. It was just, but I was like, I was that sick and I had a bad back. It was just, Jesus. It just sucked. So I remember coming back on the flight and I just was like hunched over feeling, and it's just bad for your posture and it looks horrible. So yeah, I just started working out way more and met my back. I remember seeing a physical therapist. She's like, it looks like you've never lifted a weight in your life. Like, she's like, you have no muscles in your back. And I was like, yeah, I get. So it was pretty humiliating for a woman to say that to you, for one thing. And then I started to see a guy. He's like, I'll do cardio all the time, but I exercise for the high. I exercise for the, you know, so I feel good on the road, or I feel you kill the depression at least temporarily.
Yeah, you never hear about that. Usually men, I guess men and women, you work out so people will want to fuck you. And then also to relieve some anxiety or whatever. But I've never heard of someone that's like, I got to work out because my back is just cotton candy shit. And I can't support myself if I don't do push-ups.
It's a lot. It's not even push-ups. It's like deadlifts and shit like that I have to do. It's like, it's stuff. Yeah, it's just, I just have to strengthen it. I feel so much better. I'm seeing like, I see a French trainer now and he's awesome. And he talks shit to me and he'll take me to the park and make me box him. And he'll say shit like, I'm going to humiliate you in front of all these women. Like, he's fucking hilarious. So
that's great. I might hire him just for sex.
Oh, he's a fucking hot man. He is very handsome. But yeah, he's a badass. He's like a track and field champion. So I've been working out with him, and I just feel better after seeing him.
Yeah, I assume that helps your like mental health as well.
So much, so much. It's crazy. I need that boost.
This is the issue I have with, and it's funny because we both have like hot trainers. I go to Diego. I go to a Colombian fucking trainer. I love that we all have like sexy personal trainers.
Well, you should. If you're a trainer, that just helps business. If you just look good, I mean, we've seen trainers who are like, I'm like, you're a trainer, and it's kind of like, how the fuck do you get clients when you have like a weird body, you know?
Well, fucking Richard Simmons. That was that great George Carlin joke. He goes, Richard Simmons is proof that you can work out 18 hours a day and still look like shit.
Well, dude, they're NBA players. I'm like, all you do is cardio and you have a belly. Like, it makes no sense. So, yeah, you gotta be ripped if you're a trainer.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's hard as we get older to be in great shape, but I need I don't know if you're like this with exercise. You're better than me, because I remember we were on the road one time together and we went to the gym and you like did like a full workout. I go to the gym legitimately for like 8 minutes. I do curls, a couple bench presses, and I'm like, all right, let's go steam. But I need to get cardio with people in a class or play it. Yeah. Like if we play basketball, I can get good cardio that way. Or yeah. if I go for a run, I can do it. But it's so hard for me to fucking motivate. That's why I go to MMA, because he'll just beat the shit out of me a little bit, yes. Which helps.
Yeah, that helps when someone's doing that. Like this guy, I'll be doing deadlifts with him. And normally I would just give up, but he'll be like, no, no. And I'm like, all right. So he like scares me into going. I need that. I need that motivation.
It's so fucking hard for me. I'm like this with writing, because you're obviously such a disciplined writer, but I think it's almost a compulsion with you. It feels like it takes so much for me to start writing, and basically I need you to either be bouncing bits or I catch your act and I'm like, all right, fuck, I gotta try to somewhat keep up.
I just like, for me, I just get anxiety if I don't have new material. I just always I'll try to do enough sets where I hate the new jokes, where I'm like, I gotta get new jokes. I hate the new stuff too now.
It's funny, I'm
sick of them.
That's what I kept saying during pandemic when we weren't doing stuff, because I barely wrote at all during pandemic. I tried to write other stuff and wrote a movie and shit, but that will never be anything. But I only write bits because I'm tired of the other bits. That's why being on the road for me makes me prolific. Like, I'm not prolific because I feel like I got to put out a new hour. It's just because I'm like, I cannot tell this goddamn joke again. I got to replace it with something.
Yeah. I hear myself tell a joke and I'm just like, If I feel sick of it, that's like time when I'm just like, I don't want it to. It's weird. A lot of it's like whatever you feel comfortable telling in the city. Because on the road, you kind of have to do all the new stuff, because it's the new stuff. You got to do it. But in the city, I'm doing 15 minutes. I'm like, you can at least mix and match a little bit. You can have a little more fun with it. And if I'm sick of the joke, I can drop it in a 15-minute set.
Yeah. There's nothing worse to me than being on the road. I don't want to get too inside baseball here, but being on the road and doing like 6 headlining shows, and then you come home and do like a cellar spot on Sunday and you're like, I absolutely cannot do all the shit I was just doing at this goddamn cellar spot.
Okay. Oh, because you mean the road was hot and the cellar, it's not as strong as you thought?
Well, you're just tired of doing it. I'm just fucking exhausted from that shit, and I'm like, I already worked it out there. So where are you on like Nate Bargatze and Tim Dillon? A lot of these guys are like, you don't need as many sets, you can take time off. But again, it feels like a compulsion for you.
Yeah, if I take nights off, it's a big deal for me. I don't like taking nights off. And like, that's cool. Those guys feel that way. I mean, they're probably on the road a ton, so they're working stuff out, and maybe they just see the value in working out for their fans more. But I'm on the road a lot, but I like working out for people that don't necessarily know who I am, or you know, that way you really have to make the joke. Something about bombing a joke. I was kind of bombing the other night at New York Comedy Club. And because I was bombing, I found a couple more punchlines because I had to. Because I was like, I just need to riff a better tag because this won't hit.
Absolutely. And,
so I it's not like I want a bomb, but I see the value in bad crowds still.
Right, right. So I'm so interested in this because you're such a fascinating guy to me because you, I mean, Gary Veeder and I talk about this all the time. You just ruin our mental health because really? You're like, I got it. You're like, what do you got? Here's my new bits. You're like, what do you got? And I'm like, I have nothing. I don't have anything. Fuck.
And you it, just it go me- up there and the jokes work, though. I feel like I have to. My batting average is shit. So I feel like I have to constantly be putting stuff out.
Well, that's what I have to remind myself for my own mental health is that when I have it turned off a lot because I'm just doing other shit or whatever. And then when I turn it on, I can usually crank out some material. That thing of like, I got to come up with some material. I can usually get something and I have a high batting average. You, I feel like, are just writing jokes all day, every day. And whatever, 20% of them are the best jokes that anyone has.
I wouldn't even say 20%, but I just try to get into a routine of it because I think I'm like, well, I'm not going to be one of the best comics. So let me just write as much as I possibly can. I think I heard Leno say that once where he's like, I need to write all day because I need to outwork everybody.
Okay. So this is what I want to get to. And this is what's interesting to me. And it can be relevant for people that aren't in comedy. What do you think it is that makes you that way? So driven? Is it pain?
Oh, it's my family. It's my family for sure. I mean, like my brother and sister. Okay. Well, my brother and sister, my dad never stopped working ever. Like he never stopped working. And my mom is, you know, my mom is very creative. My mom's an artist. So, you know, we work, you know, like I think she always encouraged creativity. I don't think she wanted me to be a stand-up. I think that freaked her out for sure. But, you know, I think there was a period where I just was a stand up for the free drinks. I was like, I get free drinks at work. And she was just like, oh, she just see me drunk on stage. She'd be like, this is terrible. And my dad's a workaholic. So we're a blended family. So he's, you know, he's my stepdad. And then my brother and sister who are older than me are step siblings. We're just like fucking geniuses. So it was insane. So I just felt like the black sheep. I was the black sheep. So I think there was that need to, when I was a kid, my need to stand out was to be the biggest fuck up. Cause I was like, well, I'm not going to get better grades than them. They're both honor students. They're both, you know, they're both Ivy League lawyers. So, I had no chance of standing out in an academic sense, but I was like, I'll stand out by getting drunker than everyone. I'll stand out by being the bad kid, by always being in detention, by always being in trouble. So, you know, at a certain point that shifted, I think I just had a low self-esteem, but at a certain point that shifted. And, I think I just started doing, I love comedy so much that once you start doing well on stage, it kind of changes your perception of yourself. And, I was like, first off, I think we're in the same boat where we got into this. Like people thought we were funny. And then I got into this and I was like, fuck, I have to work really hard at this. I thought I could just kind of bullshit my way through this, but I'd see comics that I looked up to and I'd see their discipline and how hard they worked. I mean, like Dave Attell was a guy I look up to. And then Dave Attell, I'd see how much he would write. And I'd be like, this is insane. So you get into this kind of because you're a fuck up. And then you end up having to treat it like a real job. And I think that was something that kind of pushed me is like, this is my only, I won't survive in this if I don't work hard.
Yeah.
This is a job that's we're lucky exists. It's ridiculous. Right. I was doing a pedophile joke on stage yesterday and it didn't kill. And I got annoyed that they didn't laugh hard. I'm like, what a silly job this is.
Yeah, it's insane. Well, I mean, I guess you're lucky to realize that earlier. I mean, it took me 10 years and I tell this all the time. Like I fucked up so bad. I had to find a new group of peers. Like I started like you and Mark started significantly after me because I just fucked around for so long. But when I started in Boston, I had this like phenom thing because I was 18. I was like just out of high school and I was pretty good. I was like a naturally funny for guy. Sure. And so everyone was like, you're going to be big. Everyone kept telling me that. They're like, you're going to be something. And I kept going, great. All right. And so I just kept boozing and not writing that much. And I did the thing that all those Boston guys did, but I got like 25 minutes. And the other thing that those guys in Boston did, who I love all them, but everybody was, and my family's like this too, everybody would kind of cut you down. It was a lot of like, nah, that's bullshit. That guy claims he has 45. He doesn't have 45 minutes. It took me 10 years to have 45 minutes. And so I got that in my head of like, shit, I must not have any time. And so I kept lowering myself and I, of course, low self-esteem and all that. And it wasn't until I've told this story before too. I was working with DePaulo. I started opening for him and he was just so naturally funny. And a good comic, you can't tell that they do a ton of work. It's like that duck analogy that looks like they're just floating across the water, but underneath they're pedaling really hard. We were sharing a condo because there was some big event in town. And so we were sharing the condo, which Nick was very upset about. But I remember sitting there and watching. I mean, he was like, he's like where we are now. It's like if we had to share a comedy condo with Feature. But I was watching like some bullshit on TV and I looked in his bedroom because the door was open and he was like in his underwear and he had like two notebooks out and he was listening to his set and he was like transcribing shit. And I had like an epiphany of like, oh, that's what's going on here. That's why he's 100 times funnier than me. He's doing shit during the day. He's working on this thing. And it was like an epiphany because, and I had that with Mark too. Mark and I went on the road. He was emceeing and I was featuring
with DeRosa,
right? DeRosa, yeah.
I remember this. I remember when you guys were telling me you were going out to work with DeRosa on the road and I was like, oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, it was fun. We all had the same manager, but Mark was the MC, if you can believe it. And he was like, he's like, I noticed, he's like, ah, I don't want to be weird, but I noticed you don't have a right. When do you write? And I remember being like, who's this piece of shit pimple? I'm like, I write, you fuck. But he was like, no, I'm not trying to be an asshole. He's like, I just haven't seen you with a pen or open a notebook at all.
That's because the most confrontational Mark has ever been in his life. That's hilarious.
Yeah, well, I think it was just like that curiosity, but it was
point. He's being supportive though. In a weird way, that's him being supportive because he loved you early on. So it's like, hey, you're a great comic. Why aren't you writing? And that's kind of what he's saying, right?
Yeah, well, I think he was just curious of like I have this, like, to use an analogy, I bite my nails, but I bite them in the shower. So everyone always says, I've never seen you bite your nails ever, but your nails are all gnarled. I think he was like, when are you doing this? I'm confused. And it was hard because I was like, fuck, like it was like someone calling me out accidentally, I guess. But wow. I was like, yeah, I don't write.
Damn. Yeah, it's weird because so many of those Boston comics, like that seemed like such a scary scene to me. Like it was kind of like they're drinkers, they're kind of tough. I mean, they felt like the Peaky Blinders or some shit. There was like some intensity where you're like, Jesus, these guys are hardcore.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's still a lot of, there's a few comics that do write and a lot that just don't. But that's the thing is like, I started hanging out with you guys and I'm like, all right, I can't be blown past by like another group of people. I got to try to keep pace. And so a lot of it's just trying to keep pace. But I mean, I'm always like blown away by your ethic because there's no workaholics in my family, I don't think.
Well, my dad was such a workaholic and I was kind of like, I think it was weird. It was like, you talk about you having a second chapter kind of this was like almost like my second chapter, but with my family, I think where at first, I think they were just, it's, I'm my mom's only biological son. So I think there was a thing where she was like, oh, she worries so much. I've never met someone who worries more than my mom. Like to the point I go on the road, she's like, are you being careful? And I'm like, no, I got unvaccinated, mom. I got unvaccinated. They do that at Walgreens now. You get unvaccinated. And she's so worried about me. And when I was a kid, I think she would just, I would make jokes about being a fuck up and it upset her so much. I could just see how sad she was that I viewed myself that way. But I wasn't even trying to like, it wasn't like me trying to get pity. It was me trying to be funny. I thought it was, you know, but there's a difference between being self-deprecating and it being like too real. Like one of my really close friends from growing up is like, he's a degenerate gambler. He's a chess genius. You know, he was ranked like number two in the country in chess. He's that much of a genius in chess.
Wow.
But he had this fucked up childhood. His mom was a hoarder. They were like always nearly getting evicted because of her hoarding. And he was so fucked up and he got really fucked up. And now he's like the type of guy, he's still a friend, but he's like the type of kid, I'll do a casino and he's just there. Like I'll show up at the casino and I'm like, Adam? And he's like, yeah, you're at a casino. So I thought I'd come. I looked at your website. I'm like, Jesus Christ. All right. And he'll like call me. He's like, I woke up next to a crack pipe the other day. And I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, what? I'm being self-deprecating. I'm like, that's not self-deprecating. I'm worried about, you know what I mean? Like that's fucked up. So that's, I would kind of make like, that was like my humor. I wasn't making sense. I think my mom was just like, you see yourself in this way that upsets me. And
right.
It took me years to shake that. And you're talking about discipline on the road with DePaulo. I mean, I got that from Mattel a lot, because we'd be on the road and he would be watching my set. He'd be like, make sure you do new stuff tonight. You know, like, make sure, because I think I wanted to impress him. So I'd want to make sure I was doing well in front of him. But he'd be like, I don't care. Like, if you do well, just do new jokes. Make sure you keep writing. And like that was like, oh, okay. Like, he thinks I'm funny, so I can now like experiment a little bit.
Right. That's so.
I think you want that. It's almost like a parent relationship where you just want them to think you're good.
Yeah.
But then also you don't want that to interfere with, you know, like Attell would say, like, the once you stop caring, you're good, you know, like, and I cared about that. And it's almost like once I stopped caring about my family's approval as much, because I knew I had it, I got better at like life and comedy. But once I felt like I had Dave's approval on the road, I was like, oh, I can like be the comic I am a little more than just going up and trying to kill. And then right. You almost just do better because you care less. You're less married to the material. You have a little, like, you watch Dave, he's so free up there. He has the best jokes, but he's not just trying to get to the jokes. He's trying to just do everything.
Yeah. It's amazing though, how long it takes to get that confidence, because I always had the thing of like that we've all dealt with, of like, I'm never going to come up with anything funny again. I'm cashed out of stuff. And Alan, our therapist, helped me with that, because he's like, well, you've continued to come up with material this whole time. Yeah. So you just will come up with it. But it's scary. It's such a scary business.
But that was a fluke. That's what I always think. I'm like, that was a fluke that time. You know, like, I'm in the same boat, like, coming up with new jokes. To me, it's like that blank canvas. It's funny. You have a blank notepad. It's filled with so much potential, but you have a blank hour. You're like, fucking kill me. This is brutal.
Well, that's why I have to get a head start. Like, I won't shoot something or record something until I have a surplus, because I'm like, I got to start with something else. But I then I get that anxiety. I go the opposite way, that I'm like, I get the anxiety, I'm going to have too much stuff. I'm like, now I have too much material, I'm going to lose stuff and forget it, which happens also. But I want to go back to your family. So your siblings are from your stepdad. That's not your mom's. Okay. So yeah. I wonder, if are you the only child your mother had?
Yeah.
Biologically? Okay. Because I wonder if there was part of her too that was like, oh my, feeling this guilt for your stepdad and whatever his behavior was.
Do you mean guilt, like what I was bringing, or you think guilt for him, you mean?
Like the idea of you being like, I'm a fuck up this thing. And then her being like, oh my God, I was with this other guy and this is his fault and it's my fault for being with this guy. Like if she had that feeling.
Hey, I'm Nolan Sykes, a host of Past Gas, the number one automotive podcast in the world. Every week, my co-hosts, James Pumphrey, Joe Weber, and I bring you some of our favorite stories from the hallowed halls of car history. From the amazing to the weird to the utterly unforgettable moments, we cover it all. Join us as we take a look at the wild stories and larger-than-life characters behind legendary cars and car makers. So if you love cars or just like a good story, check out Past Gas by Donut Media, the number one automotive podcast in the world.
You know, I think what I mean? On some level, yeah, I think when I met my biological father, it was very hard for her. I think, you know, he left a note in a safety deposit box for me. And I think she was like, I'm going to give it to you when you're 18. But I asked questions about him a little before that. And then we just never talked about stuff. Like, I joked that we're like a waspy Jewish family. We're like, it's like we were Jews, but we just didn't talk about shit. So it's kind of like, unless I brought it up, it wasn't going to be talked about.
So what year, give me the timeline, if you're all right talking about it.
Sure, yeah.
The timeline of when your biological father leaves, when your stepdad comes in.
I never met
you
him.
Find
I
out.
Never met him until I was like 19. So I didn't, he just left when she was pregnant and she wanted to keep me. And, you know, so I never met him until I was like, I was dating a girl in college who was, who both her parents were psychiatrists. So we'd be at the dinner table and they'd be like, you've never met. They would just be judging the shit out of me. You've never met him. I'd be arguing with her and she'd be like, who are you really yelling at? And I'd be like, Jesus Christ, you. But it got to the point where they kind of pushed me so much. I also saw a therapist. in New Orleans when I was at Tulane. I saw a therapist named Dr. Drell, who was very helpful. My parents sent me to him.
Yeah, he's on Death Row Records, I believe.
I got my prescriptions from Snoop. And I went to, and it was like at the Ninth Ward, and it was when it was all flooded. So it looked like I was seeing a therapist in fucking like Shutter Island. It looked ridiculous. But he was great. He fucked with me a little bit. He was like roasty as a therapist, which was not great for me at the time because I think I was dealing with a lot. And I remember he would I'd be like, oh yeah, so it was just me and my mom, and he'd be like, you and mommy against the world. And I'd be like, what's your problem?
Oh god.
So but for all that, he did help me figure out a lot. So he did help me for sure. I remember I sent my friend to him because my friend was, you know, very depressed, still is very depressed guy. He's a good friend of mine. I remember I was like, oh, you should see this guy. And he saw him and he was like, that guy's an asshole.
It's hilarious.
he was a character.
What age were you when you realized your stepdad wasn't your biological dad? Was that early or did they address that?
I was so young when they met. They probably went on their first date when I was like 3 or 4. And then, I remember when they got married, it was before they got married. So my last name was Greenberg. I'm Sam Greenberg. And then I remember being with my dad and he was like teaching me to spell. I was like 5 and he was like, this is how you spell Morell. This will be your last name now. So I remember that was like when I kind of put it together. I was so young. I was just like, oh, who's this guy? I like this guy, but who is he? And then they got married and I was like 6 or 7 and, yeah, I kind of put it together, but I was too young to, I was just like, oh, I love this guy. He's a good dad to me. So it wasn't like, it was new. And there was definitely, when you're a blended family, there are issues. So I think it's part of why I became the type of comic I was, because when you don't talk about stuff in a family and there's kind of these moments of discomfort, you feel this need to say what's not being said in a room. So I think that's why I tell, at least early on, why I started to tell jokes that would just like potentially upset people.
Right.
So I think there was this discomfort with my step siblings and like my mom, who represented stability for me, for them represented, I think, you know, the opposite. They had their own mother. So,
right.
So there was difficult and they were not particularly warm to her, and it's understandable. I mean, they were in some ways, you look at it like, oh, I got the lucky situation here. I have a new dad. I didn't have a dad of a dad. I have my mom still. I mean, in some ways I had the best of both worlds, but it was still uncomfortable. And I'd see them not like her, and we never talked about anything. It was just weird.
And how much older are they than you?
They're my brother's 5 years and my sister's 7 years.
Yeah, so that's like not a big difference as an adult, but as a child, that's insane. Like
yeah,
a 5-year-old and a 12-year-old is a huge difference.
Yeah, it was different, and there was a lot I just didn't understand. I just didn't understand a lot about what they were going through at the time.
Right, and so you guys were all in one house, I assume, because they must have been 12 or whatever, 10.
Yeah.
Do they get along with your mother now?
Yeah, they do. My sister has kids and I think that helps. And they do get along with her better now for sure. But but I have to remember, she's my mom. She's technically not their mom. So you have to remember that.
Right.
Sometimes when I'm like, oh, why didn't they do that? And I'm like, oh, it's not her mom, their mom technically, you know?
Yeah, that's such a fascinating thing. I find it always so incredibly like touching and moving, though, when somebody's such a good stepdad.
My dad's a great guy.
Yeah, I mean, that's like amazing. And it is lucky because, I mean, first of all, there's so many horror stories of stepdad. I mean, I just think of like the movies and like the alcohol. I'm thinking of like Boyhood and stuff and just like multiple alcoholic dads coming in and being a piece of shit. I mean, that's really amazing. And just like what a good guy, because it's hard to love somebody else's kid, or it can be hard anyways, you know?
Yeah. I think it takes for him to get what I do. It took a while. Like I remember he'd be more impressed by the weirdest shit. Like my name would be mentioned in a New York Times article and he'd be like, you were in the Times. I'm like, yeah, they said I was unfunny. You know, it'll be something where I'm like, they're like, comedian Sam Morell had a rough set or something. And he'd be like, the Times. And I'd be like, dad, I've been on like Conan and shit. But Yeah, it took him a while, but then I remember like the night where I think he really was like, oh, wow, this is for real. Is that we were at the Best Buy Theater, and now it's maybe called like the PlayStation Theater. It's in Times Square, but I did two shows with Jim Jeffries, and they were like 2,000 people a show, and they came in the crowd. And this is when Jim was working out that gun bit, which is one of the best bits of all time, I think.
Right,
and
I
and they saw me open for him, and I had a really good set. And my parents were like, this guy thinks Sam is funny. I think that was like a moment where they're like, oh, wow. It's funny to see them, because Jim is so not their type of comic, but they were both like, he was great, you know? So,
yeah, it's so interesting. And your mother's an artist. What kind of artist is she?
Abstract paintings, and she's great. I'll send you her stuff. She's really amazing.
Wow, that's exciting and just cool. I mean, artist, I'm like, so jealous of your life, because of course I'm like, I'm subtracting all the pain you went through, but I'm like, wow, like a really supportive dad and an artist mother. That's so cool.
Well, I have a great relationship with my mom. She's very she understands stand-up in a way that's so cool. Like I bounce bits off my mom all the time.
Yeah, that's amazing to me. You've told me that before. Now I'm interested in how, like, because obviously she's a very anxious person,
a
worrying Jewish mom, but it feels like it doesn't manifest. Obviously you have plenty of psychosis, but you don't seem like a hypochondriac worrier to me. How did it manifest, or are you? Maybe.
Well, I worry. I mean, look, I don't have any fingernails either. You know, I worry. I have anxiety, but I think she worried so much that it made me worry less. You know, because
right.
I was like, if I matched her energy in anxiety, I'd be going nuts. I get anxiety and I worry, but I try to stay busy enough that I don't worry that much. That's really my key. Is like, if I'm really busy, then I think I'll think about that's it. Same with depression. Like I get depressed, but then I'm like, let me stay so busy that I can't think about all the bad things that could potentially happen. I mean, for me, that's, of course, I get worried, but also my mom would worry. Like my mom saw me the other day, we had dinner. She goes, your teeth are discolored. Like one of your teeth is, and I was just like, oh, and my dad goes, she's actually right this time. Like that's how much my mom worries. He had to preface it with, your teeth are discolored. So I was like, all right. So she's sending me dentists. She keeps sending me dentists. That's how my mom is. She's like, you should do. I remember my ADD was so bad as a kid. I'd walk in, there'd be like a pile of ADD books on my bed.
That's hilarious.
I'd be like, I have to now organize my ADD. So, and they never went anywhere because I have fucking ADD. They're just laying there. So they'd just be like on the floor next to my bed. But I never read these books. They sent me to a 7-hour ADD seminar. It was horrible.
Oh, that sounds awful. It's like my old joke about Sudoku.
Hours. Yes.
That's insane. So first of all, I have the best dentist and he's in your neighborhood, Dr. Ganjan, who I thanked in my special. And he's right down the street from you.
Maybe I can see him.
He ain't cheap, but it's Upper All West right. Side, you know, they're your people. that's on you. But okay, so wait, I want to talk about a few things. Because you seem, I know you get depressed. You always seem more obsessive to me than anxious. And I know those are intertwined, obviously, because I have OCD and anxiety. But the way you are with women and the way you are with material, I mean, I've like, you feel such a like an obsessive person.
Well, you say that, you make me sound like a guy who shows up to a strip club with flowers saying obsessive with women.
Yeah sorry, no, I don't mean it like that, but like just like, is this text, what do you, how do I respond to this text, what do you think this means?
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. I don't want to make it sound like you're a fucking predator.
More like I just want to say the right thing and
exactly
handle things the right way. Yeah,
of course. Yeah I don't want to say it wrong. I was the same way in relationship. I mean, now I'm in an extremely healthy relationship, but I was always like that feeling. I always relate to that feeling of like, she said this, we got in a fight about this, should I have said that, what if I say this, how do I handle that? And so is that something have you ever taken medicine for anxiety or obsessive behavior or depression, any of that stuff?
No, the only medication I've ever taken is for ADD, and I really have a hard time focusing.
Yeah, I've noticed. but you're doing great right now. Whatever you're taking now is working.
I just have a few coffees, but occasionally I'll take like a sort of like Adderall type, not Adderall, but a sort of Adderall type medication, and I'll just kind of, I don't take it often. I take it very rarely. I don't want to be hooked on it.
Right, that's good. Yeah, you got to be mindful of that. I forget what I was going to say about, I started writing down a bunch of stuff that I was like interested in. Now it's all just chicken scratch. But So what was school like? Were you a good student? Because I know you had to deal with Ivy League siblings.
No, I wasn't until I became in 11th grade. I was like all A's. It just switched. It was funny. I just like I got off on being the class clown. I was such a bad kid in school. And I was such a bad student that I was like, I'm going to really whatever I wanted to be. I wanted to be like, you know, that on steroids. I wanted to be the most hardcore version of it. So if I was bad, I was like, I'm going to be bad, but I'm going to be like the funny guy in class. So I would get huge laughs in class, but I was always getting kicked out, you know? And then it got to a point where like, I think 11th grade, I started to get good grades. And I started to like not really feel that way anymore about myself. So I would still make jokes all the time in class, but the teachers would laugh. Like I would be, they'd be just better jokes, you know? Right. I went from like lifting my legs up and farting to like riffing on like the curriculum. And I was like, oh, I'm like, now everyone's laughing. It just felt better. So 11th, 12th grade, I was like honor student. But before that, I just didn't try. I was just always getting fucked up.
I feel like I'm the reverse of that in my career. I used to have like really intellectual jokes and now I'm just farting into the mic. I got nothing but dick and shit jokes right now, which I'm embarrassed by. But
oldest jokes in comedy though, for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. They're great. And I just ripped it at the Paramount Theater last night with my dick and shit jokes. But no, I was similar. Like I was a bad student. I just didn't give a fuck and I didn't have the discipline. It wasn't interesting to me because I wanted to be a comedian since I was a kid. And so college, I wasn't interested in college and I would just kind of get by. But for me, it was my sophomore year is people started to act like I was an idiot. And this is a big part of me. And I don't know how much you have. And I think this is maybe where we're different. I want to talk about this earlier. I do my best work when I get like motivated by something. I'm like an athlete. Like I feel like Jordan. I need something to spark me. Like I had an incident again with Mark where we were doing gigs with a guy who I won't name, but a friend and a great comic in Philadelphia. And Mark did this shitty thing. He's getting better as a person, but Mark did this thing where he told me what someone else said about me, which I always feel like I'm like, you're actually shittier than that person.
For sure. Yeah. I don't like that,
but I'm grateful for it because what Mark said to me, he's like, yeah, this guy, he was talking shit. He was saying like, yeah, you're just like a party alcoholic comic and you're never going to be much because you're just a drunk idiot or whatever. That's I'm surmising it, summarizing. And it was so hurtful. But it was this moment of like, I got to fucking get my shit together. And it played a role in like my sobriety and turning my career around.
Wow.
Because it was just somebody else that I respected being like, yeah, he's like a joke. He's a goofball.
I never viewed you that way. I definitely thought that you know, there was a period where you weren't disciplined enough. But I always thought you were a great comic. I always thought you were someone who I looked up to and whose work I always admired because you were such a, you know, you were so effortlessly funny. I remember we did a gig, that awful casino run we did, but I remember you just went up the night of, like after a horrible travel day and you're riffing on the city and murdering. I'm like, that's a comedian to me. So I was never worried about you. I just knew that you had more and now you are that guy. I mean, I knew it was holding you back, but I never was, I guess, I should have been more worried.
Right. No, I mean, well, I feel like we weren't that close back then. But that, by the way, that gig we did was like a bottom, like a rock. I broke down sobbing when we were on that gig together.
Right.
That was a tough week. And but we made it through. I never thought we would be that close of friends during that week.
You did that.
I
was I was driving you nuts.
Yeah, you were.
I remember you did that thing where you called my hotel room. You're like, do you have a hot tub in your room? And I was like, ha ha, very funny. Like that's like the road comedian joke. Cause I was in some tiny room. And then I went up to your room and you were actually in like the presidential suite.
Yeah, they fucked up somehow. I had this massive thing. But no, and by the way, it was my fault. I mean, you were driving me crazy, but that's cause I was a fucking drunk, bitter, drunk asshole. I mean, some of it was you also, but mostly it was me being a drunk asshole. But I've had that before too. Oh, so that's what I was going to go to in high school. I was similar to you. I was goofing around and a goof and sort of a class clownish guy. And then people started to kind of treat me like an idiot. And I failed off the track team and people thought I was like a moron. And I remember talking to my friend Brendan and I was like, no, I could make the honor roll. Like I'm a smart guy. I'm just not doing it. And he started laughing and he's like, no, you couldn't. And I got like mad and serious. And I was like, all right, watch this. And we had like, it was called block scheduling. So you only had four classes per semester. And I got two A's and two B's. Like I got like, I was like at the top of the class. I was like, there you go. Here you go. And I went back to doing C's and D's after, but it just felt like, no, I can do that.
Out of spite, you made the honor roll. That's
exactly
hilarious.
I mean, legitimately. Yeah. And I was like, there you go, everybody. Because I was just like, this is not that hard. I just don't give a fuck. I hated homework and I hated school. I liked learning. I just didn't want to do the shit. So yeah. Sometimes I still feel that way now. I have to overhear somebody say something or some kind of quip. And there's plenty of those to go around, obviously, in comedy, where you just sure. take it as like motivation. And it does feel like that sort of, not to compare myself to Jordan in level of skill, but level of motivation is how I feel. How much of that do you have, if any?
I don't want to say I have that. I think, you know, if I see you or Mark or Mackie or any of our friends on stage and your new shit is killer, or, you know, anyone, you know, I'm kind of like, oh, wow, I have to put my foot on the gas, not even a competitive way, just like, oh, I gotta wake up and I gotta write more. So it's more like I feel lucky to have friends who work really hard, because that pushes me for sure.
Yeah, that's how I feel with us too, especially as you get older and mature. And I spend way more time on mental health stuff with meditation and sobriety and all this stuff. And you just get older and you mature. I have almost no bitterness, I want to say, and not much competition, but it's like that friendly thing of like, all right, I gotta keep pace. I gotta at least have good material. And it's maybe not as much as far as selling tickets or making money, but I'm like, as far as what goes on stage, I gotta try to at least be in the same realm as these guys.
Yeah, I'm sure like on some level it started in an unhealthy way. I mean, you used the word obsessive. I think obsessive is unhealthy. To be obsessed is considered sure. a bad thing, but I do feel like you have to be somewhat obsessed to be good at this. And, you know, so I think early on it was like, I need to stand out with my siblings. Like it's always on some level, like, I don't want to be the black sheep. Like that's, and then I also had this side of my biological father's family, and he had a son he raised. So I think in a lot of ways I was always felt like passed over.
Right.
You know? So I think I picked the right business where you feel rejected constantly. Yeah, I think a lot of it started from a really unhealthy place, and therapy's definitely helped that.
Yeah, no, let's talk about Alan, because everybody, fans of this show, are familiar with Alan. How did you find Alan? How did that work? Because then you led me to Alan, which I'm still grateful for.
Oh, wow, I didn't know I did that. It's been so long, I guess, but Gary Goldman and Rachel Feinstein.
And what was there? Were you hitting some kind of bottom, yeah. or you were just, what was going on?
Rachel told me you're a depressed alcoholic, and she's like, you're always hungover, you're always depressed, you're unhealthy in relationships, you pick toxic situations. It became that thing. I remember Alan. I mean, I asked him the other day, I'm like, why am I so fucked up? And he just said, you should have seen when you first came here. You know,
right.
You should have seen how you were. And I've left a bunch throughout the years, because sometimes it gets overwhelming. Sometimes, you know, working on yourself can exhaust you, and you're like, I don't have time. I regress after breakups. I go backward. And Alan would say shit. I would quit therapy. I'd be like, I'm done with this. I'm just gonna drink again. I'm gonna be bad. And I it's like a little, whatever you call it, the Amish. What do they call their spring break?
I have no idea.
Fuck, I forgot what it's called. Rumspringer. I have my little Rumspringer where I just fuck up and become bad. But he really will look at me like I'm an athlete in my prime, retiring early when I quit therapy. He's like, no, you have a lot left. You really should not be leaving. And I went back recently. It's been huge.
Yeah, no, he's the best. You guys every once in a while be like, I took a break from Alan. And I'm like, no way. I'm like, I got to see him. I go every other week now. And a lot of the times now I just feel really healthy, but I still just like talking. It's almost like we're just friends now. I just like checking in, and I do most of the talking. I mean, he's had a bigger, he's the most important person in my life. Like as far as my mental health, like obviously if it was between him and my wife, I'd take my wife because she lets me have sex with her, but that's the only reason. I mean, as far as like improving my mental health, I mean, there's nobody that's been more significant. But no, I was bottoming out in sobriety, and I was at the Tampa Side Splitters and the condo, and called you. And
that's a rough condo.
You gave his number. Yeah, it was rough. I mean, it was horrible. But anyways, you mentioned, do you think you're an alcoholic? I mean, Rachel calls you an alcoholic. I'm like, I feel like I don't perceive you as an alcoholic.
No, I think I just drank. I think I was a binge drinker. I think there's a difference. I don't think I would like wake up and drink, but I think I would just get fucked up all the time. And I would just always be hungover. And when you're always hungover, like, dude, it's a depressant. You're going to be depressed all the time. So
yes.
I already have a hard time showing emotion. I have a hard time feeling good. I have a hard time, like, I don't, that's another thing Alan always tells me. He's like, you don't let good feelings in. He's like, you just don't. Like, it's funny, I had a girl say she, you know, wanted to move here for me, and it was like a big deal. She's like, I want to move to New York. And he's like, and how did you react? And I said oh, cool. And he's like, how do you react when the Knicks win? And I was like, wow, I'm a fuck up. I'm a real fuck up. That's right. Terrible. You know, so he's dead on. I mean, I think one of the hard things with stand-up is it's not like a lot of entertainment. You can catch a break early on. Stand-up, that really doesn't. I mean, it happens to a couple people, but like, man, it seems common for comics to break like 20 years in. And so a lot of times when we get stuff, we're not like, yay. We're like, yeah, it's about fucking time.
Right.
So that's another reason, like, he's like, this is a good thing in your career. And I'm like, yeah, but I've put the work in and I've like, there's never a moment where, like, you were talking about Michael Jordan earlier. And it's like, he's that moment where he's like, yes. And he's like holding the championship. I feel like I'll never have a moment like that.
I've always felt that way. There is no like mountaintop with comedy because you're always worrying about it. And there's no definitive, I won. Even when you shoot a special, you're like, I think that was good. That didn't hit great. You know what I mean? With a championship in basketball, you could be like, I shot 8 for 35 from the field, but we fucking won, baby.
Exactly.
We got the win. And with comedy, it's not. I used to think like in movies, you could at least win an Oscar in the movies or whatever. But I mean, it's all perspective, I guess. But no, I've had the same thing with Alan where I booked the Tonight Show a few years ago and it wasn't my first late night. I had done a bunch of stuff, but
that was a great set.
Oh, thanks, buddy. But I called him and it was like, yeah, you know, I don't know if I should invite my parents because they'll feel pressure to come down. But then do I want them there? Because then I'll feel pressure to whatever. And then who do I invite? With comics, it's sensitive because some people are jealous and some people not. And do I want this guy? And he just stopped and went, where is the joy?
Yeah.
Is there any amount of joy? Like, there wasn't one moment where I was like, I did it. And that's another thing with comedy is, you know, I love the term hedonistic adaptation, which is a thing I think about all the time, is you just adjust. Where now doing a late night, you get the call to do a late night and you're like, great, you put it in your calendar. Okay, I got this set. Let me go work the set. And you don't have that moment of like, what the fuck? I'm going on Conan, baby. Like, we lose that because we've just adapted to it. And it is a thing where it is a series of problems is a way to look at it. Cause you're like, all right, I got to get a suit. What am I going to wear? What if I bomb? Is that joke going to hit? And it's really difficult. And it really does become an effort. You have to make a conscious effort to find the joy and relate to the joy and connect with it.
It's really hard to find the joy. And, I really don't let good feelings in. Like, so many people have told me that. They're like, we don't see you like really excited. Like, you never really get excited. And I was like, yeah, I guess I don't, you know, a lot of it's just childhood, man. It's like childhood stuff. Like, I was a loud kid. My mom's like, we're like loud talking like Jews. We just kind of like, we just chat. We were like, and my brother and sister were very quiet kids, like to the point, it almost like prepared me for morning radio, having a brother and sister who were so quiet because they gave a lot of one word answers, which I never gave. I'd be like, how was your day? It was good. That was it. So I'd have to like over talk, you know?
Right.
So there were nights at the table. I'm like, well, this is kind of like a tough crowd.
Right, right. Yeah, it's interesting. My family's similar. I mean, my dad gives nothing. But for me, my thing with childhood is that came from, all right, nobody really wants to hear what I have to say. So, or nobody there anyway. So I would go and seek out other people that would listen to me, hence an audience, I think. It's because you're like, nobody's responding to anything I'm saying or doing here. Let me go find somebody. I don't know if you relate to that at all with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I was comic strip, like, you know, it was huge for me. I mean, I have a lot of good and bad stories about that club on the Upper East Side, but you know, I met Joe Mackey there. We became really close instantly. And, it's fun when you just meet someone who just immediately you're like, fuck, this is what comedy should be. Cause you're, it's funny, your first group, you're like, this will be the group. We'll be the group. And then like, you never see 99% of those people ever again. But well, Joe, I did see again a lot.
That's where I feel so grateful for you guys, for you and Mark and Phil and Veter and Mackie, and not a diverse group, but
in skin tone or style.
Yeah, but and Soder and Vecchio and all those guys. But anyways, but boy, we really need a black friend. This is bad news. But no, I mean, that's, I forget what I was going to say. Fuck. Oh, that, I had that when I started in Boston. I made this group of friends and I was like, we're going to all fucking support each other. We're all going to do these things. And I'm still close friends with all those guys. And I consider them like family, but they ended up staying there. They didn't have the common goals or the ability to move, whatever it was. And so now having you guys where it's like, I'm working on this, he's doing this. It's so exciting and like a dream come true to have a group of friends that are all pursuing it like hardcore. And the greatest accomplishment in my life is getting to a point where I can really enjoy other people's success, which took a long time. I mean, as an alcoholic and somebody with anxiety and self-esteem issues, there's a long time and it's tragic that you just get bitter and upset when people get stuff, which is like the greatest tragedy of my life, that there was a period in my life that people I loved would get success and I would be upset about it. And to now have this,
it's
like
poison, it's poison for your life, man.
Oh.
It's terrible. Cause you want to, look, I've been there to some degree myself, and you want, if they're your friend and they're fucking funny, then it's a win for you and it's a win for comedy, you know?
Absolutely. And it's that thing of a rising tide lifts all boats. It's so funny to you get bitter. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, more people know who we are because of this. And it's just like, oh, right. But I had relationships.
And also it's a huge moment in their life, you know?
Yeah. Well, that was a great moment in the Marc Maron, Louis C.K. Podcast. If you remember that episode,
sure,
it was like, it's like a fucking movie. It's amazing. And Maron is just so honest. He's like, yeah, I was just getting bitter. And Louis's like, well, you're being a shitty friend. And it really hurt me. And it's just like so touching. I mean, I don't know what their relationship is.
Maron's a complicated guy, but, you know, it's tough. Mark is such a great interviewer and such a legendary comic too. But it doesn't mean you still don't have work to do on yourself. We all have work to do on ourselves, you know?
Yeah, of course. No, he's fantastic. I mean, that show made me want to do this show. You're like, oh, I want to have some conversations like that.
Doing his show was a highlight of my life. It was one of the highlights comedically, because it's like it was such a groundbreaking podcast, and he is such a great interviewer.
He's tremendous. Yeah. No, I'm like, that's like a guy I don't know at all. I've only talked to him for that 1 hour and then 10 minutes in Montreal one time. But I'm like, I love that guy. I have so much like reverence for that guy.
I remember his Letterman sets and just being like, man, these are kind of edgy sets. I thought it was so cool. And I remember opening for him like 10, 11 years ago in San Jose at Rooster Teeth Feathers. And I was like featuring. I broke even on the weekend, but I just want to work with him. And it was pretty cool. It was like right when he started selling out on the road. So
I remember I was at the Cellar one time and I was on stage and I just saw him like in the little, you could see the doorway. Sometimes someone's just waiting there. And I saw him and I was like, oh my God, this is Marc Maron. So I just immediately shifted gears and went into like my anxiety material. Cause I'm like, he's going to see this. He's going to see this and be like, this guy's a genius. And then he didn't even acknowledge me when I came off. And he probably was like, oh, here's a guy doing my shit. I mean, like I realized that is the worst thing when you see someone in that fucking doorway that you admire and you're just like, oh, it just fucks with you.
Yeah, I don't like looking. I just kind of want to do my thing.
Well, I was always so grateful because the first time Louis saw or heard me, he was sitting in the steps, but he didn't come into the where you can see. And it made me so relieved, because if I had seen him, I probably would have been like, oh, boy, and started fumbling and shit. But it's nice to
I remember when he saw you at Irish Exit. Wasn't that when he first saw you?
I think he saw me at the Cellar first. No, it was at the Cellar. Yeah, because I had just started doing this new joke. And he's like, is that like your classic bit? And I was like, no, it's brand new. And he was like, oh, wow. That was big. I think he saw Veter at Irish Exit and loved him.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah.
But anyways, we got to wrap up. I know you have somewhere to be. But man, this is so fun. I love time. It's, first of all, just nice to catch up. Now it's like we need podcasts to catch up with people. It's such a horrible.
And anytime the podcast will just call me, man. I miss you.
Yeah, man. It's always good to see you. And you're fucking kicking ass, man. You're like my favorite comedian. It's so weird. That's a weird thing about comedy too, is when your, which makes sense. It never even occurred to me that eventually your peers become your favorite comedians, which is so strange.
Because
you're always like,
you
like Carlin and I like Eddie Murphy. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, Sam and Nate Bargatze are my two favorite comics.
And dude, your bit about the guy talking shit to your wife and like, hey, you're just like, well, we're very sorry you feel that way. And you just grab the way you act out and put my, like, that's like every favorite part of my bit, like a working act out, self-deprecating, unpredictable. Like, that's such a great, you have so many great bits. I mean, your Netflix half hour is just like the most, one of the most bulletproof. I love half hour. I'm a big half hour special fan.
Me too. I agree.
I don't get why. Like, I think all my, I don't think I'm ever going to put a special out over 50 minutes. Why? You just lose people. The your fans will, I guess, watch it all, but then you're trying to get new people. I think more specials is the way to do it.
Yeah, I agree. And I always like 45 minutes. I'm like, I do 45 on the road. That was like a club set when I was started, when I was coming up, and especially nowadays, an hour is just fucking long. People don't have the attention spans for that shit.
An hour 10 of stand-up is like a four-hour movie.
Right. It's just, it's like, what are we trying to prove here? But no, it's fun. And I'm excited to see your shit. I mean, like, I'm glad you exist, because when I see you, it makes me want to be better. Or it makes me have
you
to
too,
be better.
Man. You too. I love your stuff.
All right, well, plug some of the stuff. Plug the podcast, and
well, I have a basketball pod a basketball pod with Stavros called Pod Don't Live, a drinking pod with Norman called We Might Be Drunk. I have two specials on YouTube right now. Up on the Roof, which was my pandemic special, and then I Got This, which is tighter jokes, but it's, you know, it's more of like a actual special. But Up on the Roof is kind of like a messy, fun special. But yeah, doing the road. I'm on the road like every weekend of the year. I can't wait. I love it. I'm loving being on the road more than ever. I already loved it, but now it's like, oh, this is what it's all about. This is the best.
That's great. Fucking kick ass. Yeah, I feel like I'm just trying to keep pace with you. So I appreciate it. I appreciate your time. I know you got
to
run. Thanks so much. That's Sam Morrell, everybody.
Mindful Metal Jacket is hosted by comedian Joe List. Produced by Joe List. Edited by Matt Kleinschmidt. Executive producers Robert Kelly and Matt Kleinschmidt for the Laugh Button Podcasts.